Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Exorcist Believer, Pet Sematary Bloodlines, Loki Season 2, Strange Way of Life, and Maestro. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring It Came From Outer Space. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I don't care about Taylor Swift. I mean, I have nothing against Taylor Swift. I actually once interviewed her when she was like 16, before she ever became big. And she was adorable. I mean, she had stars in her eyes at that time. And I think it's neat that she's going to be opening this movie next week. That's stuff I'm interested in. I don't care who she's dating. Why is it news that Taylor Swift is dating somebody? She dates people all the time. I don't care about football, so I have even less interest in this whole situation. So I'm going to move on from that because that's been dominating the entertainment news for the last couple weeks, and it's infuriating. So let's talk about the box office instead. Last week, big surprise, Paw Patrol beat out the other movies last week and actually beat it pretty significantly. I mean, it wasn't a devastating match, but it was like almost $23 million for Paw Patrol. And that was a good like $4 or $5 million more than Saw 10 did. And then after that was The Creator, which was at $14 million, which is not good for The Creator. Both Paw Patrol and Saw are doing fine. I mean, I think the numbers for Saw weren't as good as they wanted them to be, especially if you look at the past and compare it to previous releases. But still, these Saw movies are not that expensive to make. And the only real name they had in this was Tobin Bell. So, I mean, this thing was made on the cheap, and it's probably profitable by the time I'm done speaking this sentence. But The Creator wasn't. The Creator was a big deal. And one of the things, even though I haven't seen it, but one of the things I've heard about The Creator, which caused a problem for it, is it had a positive view of AI. It's sort of like the story being this guy's got to stop this weapon that the machines have built, and it's an AI, but it's almost like, oh, it's an AI, live and let live. And I don't know if we want that. I mean, that makes sense in a Star Wars world where you're like, droids are people too. But real artificial intelligence, if you create artificial intelligence, you don't know what, if it starts to actually become self-aware and actually has a protection mode coming, a self-preservation switch that turns on, it may not be good for humanity. A better artificial intelligence movie is something like Ex Machina, if you watch how that plays out and how people could be manipulated. So that, I think, was a big problem for The Creator. And then Barbie actually dropped out of the top five and it dropped down to like 10th place, which isn't devastating. I mean, it's over $633 million anyways, but it lost all of its IMAX screens and because it had beefed up its IMAX screens and then it dropped all those. So that's why it had such a huge drop. But this is the first time it's been out of the top five since it was released. And that is impressive, to say the least. Couple pieces of news I also wanted to highlight. The first one is Disney's VFX workers have voted to unionize under IATSE, which IATSE's mostly known for the crew of like Broadway, you know, the stagehands, the people who move stuff around, the people who basically the support crew and visual effects departments have wanted to unionize because we've heard stories going on for better part of a decade or more about how poorly they've treated the visual effects workers and how much they lean on them and take advantage of them. And you're going to see more of this. You just had a writer's strike. You have an ongoing actor strike and you've got video game strikes going on. So you're going to see unionization start happening. It's getting more powerful for the unions, at least in the entertainment world, but also in just regular. I mean, you got an auto worker strike going on. So, yeah, I think you're going to start seeing a shift towards more unions, which kind of works with the way the economy has changed over the years. The final piece of news is this little bit that I saw that Paramount decided to drop Mean Girls onto TikTok. And they did it on what, like the 5th, October 5th or something like that, which I haven't seen Mean Girls in years, but I think October 5th has some significance in that. And they took the whole movie and broke it up into like 26 parts and put it on TikTok. And a lot of people have questioned, you know, is that a way to get around the residuals? Because that's not part of a streaming platform. And that may be true. I think it may have just been a stunt by Paramount, but that goes to show you something about a younger generation. For all you people out there that are over 30, or people like me who are over 50, the new generation is not into watching stuff on a TV across a room. They'll watch stuff in some ways on their phone is the preferred method. People who will sit in a room with a 70-inch TV across the room and they'll still watch stuff on their phones. That's Gen Z for you. And you can sit there and besmirch them and dismiss them all you want, but that's what it is. You can be upset about it, or you can recognize that this is where things are trending, at least as we go forward. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to talk about is The Beekeeper, which comes to theaters on January 12th.
Mrs. Parker and I were friends. She was the only person who ever took care of me.
I just got a message saying that there's a problem with my computer.
Yes, ma'am, we got this.
Yesterday, she shot herself.
This is private property.
Do you know what they do here? Scamming the weakest in our society.
Buddy, I'm counting to three.
One, two, three. There. I did it for you. I'm going to burn this place to the ground.
If it's January, there's got to be a Jason Statham movie coming out. January releases tend not to be big releases at all. There have been some that have done well and some have carried over. But this is just a bona fide like January release. Like, it's not part of award season. I mean, for a Jason Statham movie, it looks fine. I mean, it's absurd and it's silly. And there's like a scene in the trailer where he's literally beating up all of these FBI guys. And they're in flak jackets and helmets and they've got guns and knives. And somehow he's beating up everyone with his bare hands. So it is a bit absurd. But it's a Jason Statham action movie. What do you expect? It might be fun to watch. The next one I want to talk about is The Toxic Avengers, which is in theaters soon. I mean, it debuted at Fantastic Fest last month. It does not have a release date yet, but I imagine it's going to be coming out soon. I don't know if it'll come out before the end of the year. It seems it should, at least to capitalize on some Fantastic Fest buzz. But anyways, it's the latest remake or reimagining of the Toxic Avenger.
The freaky folk hero remains at large. Sir, what did you see last night?
I heard gunshots, saw blood. Handsome fella had his arm tore off like wet bread, and the creature run off into the night.
Breaking news. A group of armed extremists beat nasty lads. They've taken hostages at a Miss Meat Lunchatorium downtown.
Let's go live. The Toxic Avenger.
That's what the kids are calling him. I think it's swell.
Now, you don't see a whole lot in here, but the one thing you do get from this is you do get the tongue-in-cheek, screwball approach that Troma has always had. And if you've never seen a Troma movie, don't speak about Troma movies. And I mean, real honest-to-God Troma team movies, you know, stuff like the Toxic Avenger series, or Class of Nukem High, or Surf Nazis Must Die. Yes, there are some movies that have been distributed by Troma that they've acquired, but I'm talking about these are the ones that Lloyd Kaufman developed himself. And the Toxic Avenger movie is very funny and very silly and tongue-in-cheek and not meant to be taken seriously, but it's also very graphic and gross at times. So you get that feel from the trailer, and it looks like at least it's going to be authentic. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Strange Way of Life and Pet Sematary Bloodlines.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some new films in theaters. The first one is Strange Way of Life. Pedro Almodovar directs this short film about two men with an intimate relationship in the Old West who clash when one tries to bring the other's son to justice.
She was a whore, Father.
A woman was found killed in town.
You never loved me. You never loved anyone in your life.
Don't say that.
Years ago, you asked me what two men could do living together on a ranch. I'll answer you now.
If you remember last week, I was talking about the wonderful story of Henry Sugar. And even though this has nothing to do with that, it's a short film. Henry Sugar was 39 minutes, and this Strange Way of Life, I think its total running time, head to tail, is 31 minutes. Now, Almodovar did another short film about 3 years ago, and I can't remember the name of it, but it stars Tilda Swinton, and Sony Pictures Classics is bundling those two movies together, releasing it in cinemas. And I said this last week, I said, I would love to normalize doing short films. I love short films. I've always liked short films. I think they're a different type of art form than a full-length narrative. And even if you remember what I said about Henry Sugar, I'm like, you would have completely changed the flavor of the story if they had fleshed out the entirety of that story into a two-hour movie. And what's interesting is Strange Way of Life feels like it was a part of a movie, and it could be a longer movie. But the characters, you got Pedro Pascal, who plays this cowboy who rides into this town, and Ethan Hawke plays the sheriff, and Ethan Hawke's character has to track down Pedro Pascal's son, who is wanted for murder. And they also have a relationship. And when I say intimate relationship, I'm talking an intimate relationship. Just because it was the Old West doesn't mean this stuff didn't happen. And Pedro Almodovar's stuff deals with awkwardness and relationships and you know, love and how love can conflict sometimes catastrophically with duty and honor and ideas and what you think is right or what you think you should do. So it's an interesting story examination. And on that level, I think this one could be expanded, because it felt somewhat incomplete. And both Ethan Hawke and Pedro Pascal do a great job in their roles. They're both very good actors, and they're both game, and they're both committed to it. There's these weird moments in the movie, though, where every now and then this story just goes slamming into cliches. I mean, it's beautifully shot. As a Western, most Westerns look great. And Almodovar deals with complex relationships. And I think he handles it well, but every now and then it runs into either like a visual cliche or a Western film cliche. That's when it just suddenly becomes unauthentic for like 5 seconds and then it kind of writes itself and gets back on track. I mean, it's an interesting movie. It's worth seeing. Like I said, I want to see them normalize short films more, but I think it's it. I mean, it's beautifully shot and it's well acted. This examines a complex relationship and managed to mostly avoid cliches. I'm going to say that Strange Way of Life kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Pet Sematary Bloodlines. This prequel to the 2019 version of the Stephen King classic tells the story of how Judd Crandall learned the hard truth about the spirits in the ground of Ludlow, Maine.
First place I learned about death was a pet cemetery. A secret place. Generation to generation, dead things buried in that land would come back as something else. I think something's wrong with Timmy.
He needs time to adjust.
Sometimes dead is better.
This is available exclusively on Paramount Plus, and we're starting to see streaming services settling in and realizing, okay, there's these movies that we can do that would have been like a direct-to-cable release in the past. They're just dropping exclusively on their streaming service. You saw that a couple weeks ago with No One Will Save You on Hulu. I support that idea. I like the idea, again, of having something new on the streaming services. I think it would be a mistake for these companies that have spent all this money and put all this money to build these services and build a product and then just put in old stuff. You got to have some unique content there to justify the price that they're ratcheting up right now. Now, I'm a huge Stephen King fan. Well, I'm a huge early Stephen King fan. I pretty much around the early 90s, I stopped reading his stuff. It's weird. I've always said this about Stephen King. When he got sober, I thought his writing suffered. And that's a shame because good for him for getting on the wagon. But unfortunately, I didn't like where his stories went. I liked his earlier stuff that was twisted and weird. And Pet Sematary is a great book. It's disturbing, but the original movie from 1989, I really enjoyed. The one from 2019, I could not stand. And this one, it's tied specifically to the 2019 remake. And unfortunately, they don't have the character of Judd back in the 1989 version. Fred Gwynne played and he's most known for being Herman Munster, by the way. He played Judd Crandall, and that's where you got that great line where he says with that thick New England accent, sometimes dead is better. And in this movie, you don't have that authentic New England sound to them. Now, they do have Henry Thomas in this, which I think is great. It's just this weird connection between the E.T. actors and Stephen King. You know, Drew Barrymore did a bunch of stuff with Stephen King when she was young, and Henry Thomas has shown up in a bunch of Stephen King stuff lately. But I love the idea of going back and telling Judd's story, because it's told in flashback in the movie, or in the book, too. But there's just some real problems. It's really just clunky writing. There's real clunky dialogue. There's clunky writing. At times, it doesn't quite make sense. Still, there's several things in this movie that happen, and I'm not exactly sure how it happened or why it happened. And one of the things I did not like about the remake is they address the fact that when he puts the child in the pet cemetery, that it was the body had been prepared for burial, had been embalmed, and the organs and brain was removed. I don't know, somehow that makes it less creepy. Because the whole thing is this guy has, his son has come back, his body came back from Vietnam, and so he buries him. Which not only is, you're talking, how long does it take to get a body back in 1969 to the States, but they're supposed to be, like, pretty soon you're supposed to bury him. I don't know, it doesn't make sense, and the characters are inconsistent. The intriguing idea is just weighted down with this bland writing and inconsistent supernatural elements. I just did not like this movie. It was, it didn't have the spark that you needed for this. I mean, this felt like a reanimated version of Pet Sematary. So I'm going to have to say this kind of sucked.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Exorcist, Believer, and Loki Season 2.
Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about The Exorcist, Believer. When two girls show signs of possession, their families call on an expert to help save their daughters.
Angela, can you tell your dad how long you were gone?
A few hours.
Baby, you've been gone 3 days.
What did you say?
I didn't say nothing.
I thought I heard you say something.
Wherever those girls went, they brought something back with them.
The body and the blood of Jesus Christ.
You have some experience with possession.
Yes, more than I'd like.
I talked about The Exorcist last week, and I talked about it being the gold standard for possession movies. And what's funny is The Exorcist movies are like sort of like the Halloween movies where the sequels get bad very quickly. The third movie, I think, is a fantastic film. It's a good film. The second one's lousy, and the fourth slash 4.5 version, because there's two different versions of it, I think it was directed by Rennie Harlan, and then they re-edited it. Those aren't very good. And this one, I was hoping we get something good out of it. I thought, you know, enough time has passed since they've done an Exorcist movie. You had David Gordon Green directing it. Look what he did with the Halloween franchise. I'm like, oh, this guy might have something interesting to do. And I'll give him credit. He swings for the fences on some of these things. He makes some bold choices. I mean, the idea of just having two girls getting possessed, I think, opens things up. He also sort of jettisons the Catholic ritual part of it, which is that's kind of like the whole thing of the first movie. And if you read the book, you go all the way back to the source material. I mean, William Peter Blatty, I think he was or at least trained to be a Jesuit, and he brings with him a lot of theology. And they sort of kick that theology to the curb, but at the same time, try to make it this weirdly all-inclusive thing. And look, I'm this is not me complaining about inclusion. It just this seems like a weird time to put it in. Because I've always said when it comes to, in particular, possession movies, is Hollywood's very secular until they do a movie about possessions, and then everyone finds Jesus. But there's a huge difference between bringing in a zealous priest and bringing in a zealous pastor, sort of this, because it takes place in Georgia, so it's sort of this, well, it's not a small church, it's a pretty big church, but it's this Protestant pastor, I don't know whether it's Baptist or whatever. But it just doesn't have the same gravitas as when, like, Father Marin shows up in the first movie. It's also, and this is a trend in movies, they shoot everything in shadow. You can't see a daggone thing in this movie. And if you go to a place that has bad projection, which I saw it in, which is a crapshoot, it's like when I saw Boogeyman. I couldn't see what the heck was going on in Boogeyman because the bulb was turned so low. And I'm watching this movie. Everything's lit except for the action that's going on. It's murky and hard to, and it was so poorly projected that even the scenes in the bright sunlight, you couldn't even tell if they're in focus. And that's endemic to to theaters nowadays. Everybody who's saying, save cinema. Oh, we need to have the theatrical experience. And then they project garbage on the screen. At least run your bulbs properly. So that tainted my view of this movie. But I think even if it was properly projected, I'm watching this thing and they literally have the sunlight, everything's lit from behind. Leslie Odom's the main guy in here. You have to light him directly. His skin tone, he's got darker skin. He's a black guy. You have to light his front, or he's just a silhouette because you have everything's blown out from behind him. There's a lot of inconsistencies here. It's sort of like that Pet Sematary I was telling you about, where you're like, wait, why did this happen? And what exactly is going on? And is this a demon or what is it? And in the original movie, once you get to the exorcism, everything's built up to that specifically, and it comes from all these different directions and focuses in, and then the exorcism is freaking terrifying. Well, you watch this, and then suddenly they bring in all these people, and it's, have you ever seen a thing where you get a group of people, this usually happens when you're young, and you've never done something, you've never, say, made a movie, and you get everybody together, and you make a movie, and then you suddenly discover, as you're making the movie, how hard it is, and there's a reason they do things the way they do, and you just kind of are faking it along the way. And that's kind of what it feels like. There's no ritual. There's no grounding. It doesn't make any sense. And, you know, Ellen Burstyn's in it, and that's great. I like seeing her again, but it's kind of just this wasted part. And I mean, it feels like it was thrown in just to get Ellen Burstyn in the movie. So I was really disappointed in this. I wanted it to be better. Same thing with that last Exorcism movie, Dominion or The Beginning, whatever they were called. Those are the two different names of it. It didn't learn what was done correctly in the first film, and it didn't learn what was done incorrectly in the other films. So, I mean, it tries some interesting things, but murky cinematography and an unfocused plot fails to live up to the better films in the series. I'm going to have to say Exorcist Believer kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Loki Season 2. The God of Mischief is back, trying to save the Time Variance Authority from an evil presence at the end of the universe.
I've been pulled through time, between the past and the present.
Hello?
If what I saw is true, there's nothing to stand between this world and utter destruction.
Only one way to find out.
It's up to us. Save this place.
Whatever we do, we're playing God.
The first episode of Loki dropped this week. I've seen the first four, but I'm not going to tell you anything that happens in it. I will just say, I've always liked Loki. I liked the first season of Loki because it was so out there and it was so high concept. And I've been saying this about the Marvel stuff lately, the high concept, the multiverse and time travel and quantum realm. And then you throw in Loki stuff and WandaVision. I love that stuff. That to me, that's good old fashioned comic book stories. Well, that's a little bit high concept for your average viewer. I mean, for the people who just liked Iron Man because it was a guy in a super suit. I recognize that. You're starting to get an accessibility problem for these movies. And I think that that's where they have to go. They have to evolve. But I hope they're not betting the farm on something like Loki. Because it's out there. And it shows the conflicts and what's at stake at the TVA with Loki trying to help save things and how things have changed since last season. And the other thing is Jonathan Majors is still in this. And a lot of people have wondered whether that was going to happen, because if you recall earlier this year, Jonathan Majors was arrested and was embroiled in this potential abuse situation. And I don't know if there's been any movement on that at all, but Disney's keeping him in here. And I know that upset some people, but here's the thing. There's been no definitive proof that anything happened with Jonathan Majors. We don't know. And Disney is following protocol by not firing him in the middle of a project and then having him be acquitted or having it turn out that there was really nothing that went on. The bottom line is the character of Kang, who is the one, the He Who Remains is the name that's in the Loki movie. The bottom line is you can always change actors for that. It's cosmic stuff. It's crazy stuff. Why not? Just do it. Who cares? So they could, farther down the line, change that, but, you know, I don't know. I still think it's a little bit premature to start firing people from projects. But I'm all in for Loki. I think it's cool. I think it's less exciting as the first season, because the first season was all this new stuff in the TVA. But they have some fun stuff in there. Like they got Ke Huy Quan from Everything Everywhere All at Once, won an Oscar for that, but he's also Short Round in Indiana Jones. He's got a part in this and he's fantastic. He's a lot of fun. So I really enjoyed Loki, season two. I mean, it's not accessible for all fans. This is still a fun, high concept cosmic story that is exactly what I enjoyed about the comics. I'm going to have to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I've got a sneak peek at Maestro and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring It Came from Outer Space. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with another movie review, and this is one that's actually not out quite yet for the public, and that is Maestro. I was afforded an opportunity to go see it at the New York Film Festival, and I have some interviews with some of the people who are involved in the movies. I'll play those next week. But I got a chance to see the North American premiere of Maestro in New York. And as much as that, you know, I complained about how The Exorcist was poorly projected. I was at the David Geffen Hall in Lincoln Center. And it was just, it looked gorgeous. Because, so, I mean, at least what's great about that is you see it properly presented with the image and the sound. Now, this doesn't come out in limited release until November 22nd, and then it's going to show on Netflix on December 20th. But there is a chance to see it in the theaters before then. So let's talk really quickly about this. In Maestro, Bradley Cooper directs this examination of the life and loves of legendary composer slash conductor Leonard Bernstein.
I'm thinking of a number.
Oh, I don't know. 9.
No.
5.
No, you have to think.
I'm trying to.
It's 2, darling.
2.
It's 2. Like us, a pair. 2 little ducks in a pond.
One of the things that frustrates me about award season is there's so many biopics that come out. I get very tired of true stories, biopics at award season. There's a lot of heavy, serious stuff at award season. I'm not numb to it yet because it's the beginning of October. Talk to me in the middle of December and I'm going to be like, I'm tired of watching these heavy, drippy pieces. So I had a good, I was in a good mindset to see this movie. But now here's the thing though. I don't really know about Leonard Bernstein. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. And yeah, I mean, I'd heard the name and, you know, I'd seen West Side Story and I'd seen On the Town, but I was really never, that wasn't my thing. Leonard Bernstein was an institution in New York. If you grew up in New York, especially if you're in Manhattan, you knew who Leonard Bernstein was. And he was a very prominent public figure. And especially if you had interest in the arts and in particular classical music and you went to the symphony, I mean, it was a big deal. But I think people in flyover country, he was on TV and stuff, but he's less of an institution outside of New York. So I really didn't know much about him. And one of the things I appreciated about this is it gave us a look at Bernstein's life and the complex elements of his life, in particular the fact that, well, he was bisexual and he always struggled with relationship. He always would say, I just love people. And he sometimes just loved people a little too much, sometimes physically. And he'd have little flings and he was married. And the movie itself is really, it's about the two of them. It's about their, not their love story, but their relationship, Bernstein and his wife. And she's played by Carey Mulligan. And Carey Mulligan does a great job. Now, the other thing that happens is Carey Mulligan gets top billing in this movie because it's kind of her movie. I mean, there's a lot of Leonard Bernstein in there, and it is his biopic, but the emotional center is on her. And I remember when Cooper did A Star Is Born, and I'm like, I thought he did a good job with that. I wasn't a big fan of the movie. I just don't like the story. But I thought he did a good job directing. And this thing, this is a step up. It ratchets up. And I'm looking at this not just as a standard biopic, because he does a lot of stuff. Cinematography, it's meticulously composed. There's scenes that you can tell he shoots it a certain way so that you don't know what you're seeing or it reveals itself to be something else. There's a lot of symbolism in the scenes. There's like literally a scene where his wife, who was an actress, Felicia, her name, and she's fading away into his shadow, literally. And it's really brilliantly put together. And for people who knew Leonard Bernstein or followed him, Bradley Cooper does a great job becoming Bernstein. I mean, his kids were at this premiere that I saw. And they were like, it felt like they were watching their own father. I mean, it's an impressive acting performance by Cooper. Carey Mulligan does a really good job. And I mean, she doesn't have as big of a performance, but she does a great job with what that part is. The part's much more reserved. She sits in the background. She allows him to be the star. And Maestro's, it's very well done. I mean, it's a beautiful movie. And it's worth checking out, whether or not you're interested in that symphony. Because it's a different type of biopic. It doesn't fall into all the cliches. I mean, yeah, it does fall into cliches where somebody gets famous, they have affairs, and they take drugs, blah, 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 blah. You see all that going on. And it's because that's just life. But it's an exceptionally made movie. I mean, it's impeccably made and with a true devotion to subject matter, and it rises above your standard award season biopic. I'm going to have to say Maestro totally rocks. Check it out. And if you're going to check it out, when you see it, just see it in theaters, because the sound mix is incredible. If you go see it like in a Dolby Atmos situation or a IMAX situation. And you can watch it on Netflix too and put on headphones or something.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight isn't going to be on a horror movie. It's going to be on a science fiction movie because it's getting a 4K release. And that is It Came from Outer Space from 1953. A spaceship crashes outside a small Arizona town and the occupants begin to duplicate the population.
Yes, it came from outer space to fill the world with terror, to bring you unforgettable suspense. What was it? Where did it come from? Who were the all-powerful creatures it brought from outer space? And what did they want on Earth? You can learn the amazing answer only when you see the most thrilling picture in years. It came from outer space.
I have an interesting history with It Came from Outer Space. The local library back in the 70s at some point, I think they showed The Thing from Another World, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Village of the Damned, and It Came from Outer Space. They showed those four movies over the course of a month. And my dad took me to see him. He didn't want to go see It Came from Outer Space because they had a 3D print, and that was, you know, the anaglyph red blue lenses. My dad could be a grump sometimes, so he didn't want to go see that. So I never saw It Came from Outer Space, but he took me the other three. And I've talked about my experience with both The Thing and Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I'm not going to bore you with that again here. But so I never saw It Came from Outer Space until like I was in college. And I've seen the 3D version projected and that sort of that anaglyph version. And it's not that great of a 3D movie. The effects are kind of minimal. There's a couple cool shots, but its effects are minimal. And what's funny is there's a lot of movies about people getting duplicated, especially back in the 50s. And that was a Cold War thing. The fear that communism would take us over and we no longer had feelings. That's the entirety of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That's kind of the subtext of that movie. And It Came from Outer Space had that too. Now, what's interesting, in the subtext of this one, you've got one guy, this scientist, this astronomer, played by Richard Carlson, who was also in like a 3D movie, Creature from the Black Lagoon. And he's trying to convince everybody that these aliens may not be malevolent. They might be okay. But nobody believes him. Everyone's just like, no, we need to go after him. We need to kill him. And he's trying to save him. And the aliens are like, no, we're really good. But the thing is, they're doing stuff that doesn't seem very good. They're duplicating people. They're kidnapping people. They're threatening to kill them if they're hurt. They may just blow up the world with their rocket. So, I don't know. It doesn't seem... Their motivations are not very pure, but Richard Carlson's character still believes in them. So I think it's got this weird mixed messaging going on. I mean, if you talk about like aliens from outer space duplicating, Invasion of the Body Snatchers was a much better movie. I'm not even talking about like The Thing with John Carpenter. I'm talking about the 1956 version with Kevin McCarthy of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That was only 3 years after It Came from Outer Space, but it hinges more on the Red Scare, but done in a science fiction concept. So, but it's a classic. It's worth seeing. It's on Peacock right now. It's a rather simplified Cold War cautionary tale about xenophobia, and it doesn't handle itself nearly as well as the other classics of the time. But still, it's worth checking out. I'm going to say that It Came from Outer Space kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Fair Play and Creepshow Season 3, and probably also I'm going to have to talk about the Taylor Swift thing. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.